Hi, this is Aaron Newcomb, and on this episode of Floss Weekly, Guillermo Amaral will be joining us to talk about Cluster HQ. It's a data management system for cluster-based application development. You're not going to want to miss it. It's coming up right now on Floss Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Aaron Newcomb and Guillermo Amaral, episode 398, recorded on August 9th, 2016, Cluster HQ. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price. Because everyone deserves a good night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/floss and enter promo code FLOSS. And by Braintree. Mobile app development can be complex, but integrating your payments no longer has to be. With Braintree, your business can accept nearly every type of payment from any device with just one integration. Learn more at braintreepayments.com/floss. Hi, everybody. It's time for Floss Weekly. This is the show where we talk about open source software, projects, and the people who make them. I'm Aaron Newcomb, and I'm going to be your host for today. Randall is away. He's fallen under the weather a little bit, so we really hope that he gets better soon. We wish him a speedy recovery. We want to see him back as soon as possible. So, Randall, do your best to get better, and we'll see you soon. Until then, I'll be your host, and I'll be, of course, joined by a lovely co-host. And this week, that lovely co-host is Guillermo. Guillermo, are you there? There he is. Oh, lovely.
Yes, lovely. Lovely.
I was going to say,
Randall, you look different.
Yeah, amazing, right? How are you doing, though? I haven't seen you in a long time. We haven't been on a show together in forever.
Yeah. It's been a while. But, you know, they keep bringing us back, so that's good.
Yeah. Are you in a different room or building or something?
No, same old bunker, just a little messy. I try and keep a tidy underground, above ground bunker. It's not like that today. I just came back from Comic-Con, and that desk over there, you probably can't see, is just full of, goodies and giveaways and stuff, and I need to clean that.
Nice. Well, it's good to be back on with you today. We're going to be talking about Cluster HQ, and this is basically a company, I guess, that's formed around Flocker because of the rise in popularity of Docker and containers and that whole ecosystem. There's a need for companies to spring up and come about. And I don't know what the relationship is really with Flocker and Cluster HQ. It's one of the things we hope to find out today. Do you know much about Flocker and what it is, Guillermo?
I just know it has something to do with containers and not the shipping, kind. So that is all I know. So this is going to be interesting and educational for me. And I'm sure it's going to be educational for our listeners and or viewers.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I know a little bit about containers. I deal with them at work a little bit, and of course I work on the database side, and so there's all kinds of interaction there between people starting to use containers especially for development work. So we work with Flocker directly at NetApp to support Flocker so that people can move their data back and forth. So I'm actually keenly interested in this conversation this morning to try to figure out exactly how these things are interacting and working together. So let's go ahead and bring on our guests real quick. So our guest today is Mohit Bhatnagar. I hope I said that right.
Mohit, are you there? You're great. Yeah, that sounds good, Aaron. Nice to meet you.
Welcome to the show. It's good to have you here. So you're actually vice president, I guess, of product over there at Cluster HQ. Is that correct?
Yeah, titles aside, I'm the guy who's responsible for defining what the product's vision is, what is the strategy, what's the roadmap, what are the specifications, what are the different requirements. So anything that is related to our product and solution is what I'm responsible for.
Yeah. And you used to work at NetApp as well, correct?
I know, Aaron. I don't think we worked there together, but yeah, I was at NetApp I left NetApp in 2014, had a fun time. But one of the things when I was at NetApp, I could see that there was a significant, two things were changing. One was a significant emergence of software components in the entire infrastructure stack, right? And that was obvious that containers were going to be an integral part of it. And the second, the open source piece, and which is where it led to this journey, where at ClusterHQ, we are passionate about building open source software for Docker containers.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, so we were, so we would have been at NetApp at the same time, but I don't think we ever ran into each other. I don't remember being in many meetings with you. I apologize if we were, and I'm forgetting. Well, I have a horrible memory.
I used to run the part of the Flash business, as well as the last thing I did was the FlexPod business, which, as you know, But last I left, it was an $800 million business, and I was running the product management for that. So NetApp was a great place, had fun time, and really excited about what we're doing here.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah. Well, tell me more about it. First of all, tell everybody, I know we kind of described things in the beginning a little bit, probably awkwardly and very incorrectly, but tell us what ClusterHQ actually does.
Right. So I know you have heard of Flocker, right?
Oh,
and
yeah,
Flocker is an open source contribution. So think of Flocker as our contribution to the open source community. ClusterHQ is the name of the company. And what ClusterHQ does, if you think about containers at large, in order to drive adoption of containers into mainstream, and to me, this means across the entire DevOps cycle. So clearly, developers are one of the key users of container technology, but it is something that is going to be used at all stages of adoption, QA, staging, production. We are beginning to see emergence of containers being used in production. So for us, across the entire DevOps cycle, there's a class of problems that are related to what we call data management that we want to address. Now, clearly, data management is not the only problem. There are problems related to security and networking and orchestration. So all of those, the ecosystem needs to solve. What we are passionate about is anything that is related to container data management. In fact, our belief is that if we can solve the data-related problems of container, and I'll expand on it, I think it can create significant benefit for our customers. Flocker is our first major contribution, which focuses on delivering persistent storage for Docker volumes. And I can go into technical details on how we make that happen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we definitely want you to do that in a minute. But, you know, I'm just kind of curious how this all got started. You know, right. where did this come from? Who's the team involved? You know, give us all of the nitty gritty details.
Right. So ClusterHQ's origins lies in a company which was using containers for building its own clusters. So that's the name Cluster. Over time, what we realized that aside from lots of things that needed to do the cluster was the notion of storage. So as an example, you have Docker containers. Docker containers have data associated with it, and the original notion was, well, it's a stateless. Well, what we found is that there are significant benefits can come if you can deliver stateful aspects to a container. So we started focusing on container data management. The company started about 1.5 years back. It was founded, and it's based out of Los Altos in Silicon Valley, as well as in San Francisco. Our headquarters are in San Francisco. I think it's a very interesting that geographical mix, because when I look at what is needed to drive adoption of containers in enterprise, you can see that San Francisco being one of the hotbeds of modern technology development and users is a great location. But conversely, Silicon Valley, where there's a lot of talent exists in terms of looking at file systems, the storage infrastructures, interaction with Kubernetes communities, et cetera. So we think that having offices in both San Francisco and Silicon Valley allows us to tap into talent as well as customers. And the company is, we are about 25 people, strong, funded by marquee VCs, Excel partners, and Canaan partners. The team is consists of a number of people who have done startups, and particularly in storage and virtualization space. Mark Davis, who is our CEO, was with Versto Software. Sandeepan, who is our EVP Engineering and my partner in crime, Spent 10 years last at Google working on the, as a head of storage over there. So we have got a good set of people who represent what is needed in order to drive, build software for infrastructure that could be used by enterprises.
Yeah, great. Awesome. So I may have missed this earlier, but I mean, in terms of Flocker specifically and your relationship to Flocker, what's the relationship there? I mean, do you actively develop Flocker or how does that work?
Sure. Well, Flocker, think of this. Cluster HQ is the company, is the legal entity, and Flocker is the open source software that we have built and we continuously develop. It's open source, so we get contributions from a number of other people. One of the things I think it's remarkable about Flocker is that it's a software that it gets utilized by the storage vendors in the backend. They could be the NetApp, EMCs, IBMs, Pure Storage, Hedvigs of the world, or they could be also the software-defined storage. So AWS GC in public cloud, as well as Ceph and Cinder. So across all of these storage systems, what Flocker does, it delivers a persistence for Docker containers. So in a sense, what it is doing is if Docker has a volume associated with it, and that volume sits in any of these 20 such storage systems that I mentioned, then if a container dies or if the node on which the container was residing fails, and that container is now spawned on a different machine, the volume persistent is ensured with it. So that's what Flocker does. In terms of our relationship, as I said, it's an open source software. We welcome contribution from anyone in the community, but we are the making active contributions to it. There is deep integration that Flocker has done with Docker so far. We have done integration with Kubernetes. We are coming up with some very, very interesting new projects, which will extend the concept of Flockers with complementary products, and I'll talk about it, so as to bring the notion of data or state all throughout the DevOps cycle. So overall, Flocker is the open source software that is initially published by Cluster HQ and actively maintained by us and rest of the open source community.
Okay, awesome. Well, we've definitely come across, I mean, I've come across it in my professional life, of course.
Right.
Even on this show, we've had other folks on that have talked about Flocker. We had the Kubernetes guys on, some Kubernetes guys from Google.
Kubernetes? Do you remember that?
I'll have to go look it up. It's been a while now, but you can find that out on the website, or we can look it up in a minute. So we've had a number of people on, and we've kind of talked about, I always ask the question as a storage guy, so what do you do for storage? I guess that's just ingrained into my thinking. I've been doing this for so long. But the question always comes back. You use Flocker. So it's certainly well established in the container community as a data management mechanism. I'm just kind of curious, though, for people that may not be as technical, like what's the advantage of using Flocker, or like why would a company say, I need to go check out Cluster HQ, or I need to go use Flocker to get this done because it provides what benefit?
Sure. So let's talk about the journey of containers. One of the things I love about technology is it's continuously evolving. What we think the potential use of technology are today, it changes. So containers as a technology, actually, I heard about them first time way back in the early 2000s. It was somebody's PhD project. If you think about what Docker did with containers, and that's brilliant, is they took a technology which has benefits similar to virtual machines in terms of being able to take a certain set of resources and make it available to a larger number of users. So it essentially improves the infrastructure utilization. But what containers do is they take the VM paradigm to the next level. A couple of things they do. One is that they have significantly better portability, because I'm talking about the lib, et cetera, is sitting inside the container. It has a significantly higher portability. Also, because the OS is not sitting in the, just like in a VM, it's not sitting inside the container, the density is significantly higher. So overall, we believe that containers are going to be significantly larger portion of how infrastructure gets consumed. Now, that doesn't mean VMs will go away, but we do think that a large amount of growth will take place through containers. And the developers embracing containers in order to accelerate their application development time is clearly one of the key drivers of this container growth. So now when you think about these containers, initially containers were thought as a stateless piece of infrastructure, and you didn't care if a container had a data and that data got lost. Over time, you started thinking, wait a second, I can build a stateless container, but somewhere in that model, state exists. Now, as an example, if I'm using containers for running bunch of Jenkins agents, well, Jenkins master has a state. If I have a container which is running a web service, then the log file might have a state. If I have a web service that is using some data service through an API, well, how am I going to deploy the data services? Should it be done using bare metal? Should it be done using VMs? Should it be done using containers? So that is now leading an emergence of set of capabilities which says, yes, you can deploy containers in a stateless manner, but there are also class of applications where you do care about the data associated with containers. And that's where ClusterHQ and Flockr comes in. So what Flockr does is through our partnership with the ecosystem players, as I said, AWS, GCE, Azure, then you name any storage vendors, EMC, NetApp, HPE, IBM, Pure Storage, all of those guys, Scale.io, we actually can enable any storage to be used for containers. Now, what that means is that if you want to use your existing machine or you want to have a white box machine and you want to use it for delivering stateful containers, you use a combination of Docker for Docker Compose, Docker Registry, along with an orchestration framework. It could be Mesos or Kubernetes or Swarm, along with Flockr and your underlying storage system. And now you have a full stack that can be used to delivering a stateful service to it. So the benefit of all of this is that now you can think about having a single infrastructure. If you're building a internal cloud or a PaaS, which is all based on containers, be able to use for delivery of both stateless as well as stateful services. So that's the big benefit. Now, I do want to talk about, Aaron, as we go through this discussion, some of the other things we are doing beyond Flockr, which actually you'll find exciting because it expands the vision that we have on container data management from Flockr, which does persistent volume, to now be able to actually use it, make it available even for developers.
Well, that was actually going to be my next question. So you read my mind. I was just going to ask if Flockr was the only thing that you specialize in, but it sounds like there's some other products that you're working on as well.
Right. So let's, before I talk about what are the new products, let's just set the context of it. What Flockr is brilliant to add is be able to take a Docker volume and ensure that if that Docker volume sits on some kind of shared storage, as I said, AWS, Ceph, Cinder, any of those things, then when a Docker container moves, Flockr will go out, work with the orchestration framework, work with the underlying storage system, detach the volume, and then remount it to the new container. Well, that's all great. Well, the first set of questions then we started thinking, well, where does this volume come from? How do I capture this state? Is this the only mechanism in which we need to do persistence? So as an example, what if I'm a developer and I need to share, I'm doing my testing of a code. Well, the code is never tested by itself. There is always, at some point of time, a state is associated with the data that I'm testing against, right? So if I'm building if I'm a part of a microservice team, I'm developing a code, I got a test data with me, and I ensure that my code works against that other test data. Well, how do I ensure that my developer peers are testing against the same set of data? Well, that led to a very interesting question that gets asked is that how is the data which is within the dev environment or test data management is managed? Well, here's another example. A whole bunch of developers are writing code. They got a bunch of tests that they've come together. And QA or CI/CD system needs to do testing against it in a unified, consistent manner. Well, what's the management process for that? Well, what about staging? staging needs to do its full testing of an application coming from a whole bunch of different microservices. Each microservice has a team of developers working on it. And all of these things come together at staging environment. And that staging needs to ensure that the testing is done against the data, which is consistent with what the production environment is. Well, how do I ensure staging is using the data, which is in some sense real-time consistent with production? So this whole notion of developers sharing data with other developers, or the QA and CI/CD system taking the data from developers, or staging data taking data from prod, creates this large set of very complex ad hoc today movement of data bits in the developer environment. So that is leading us to say, in addition to Flocker, there are two new concepts that we are working on. One is the notion for Git for data. Think of Git for data is exactly what it sounds like. You have GitHub and you have a Git, which allows you to take branches of code, move it, etc. We want to do the same thing with data. You can take a data stream that might be coming from, let's say, production. After anonymization, redacting, it is now available to a developer. The developer can continuously evolve that data branch in order to build their new code. They can publish that branch of data out to other developers. It could be consumed by QA and CI/CD. So the concept of Git for data combined with a GitHub equivalent, which we are calling Volume Hub, allows us to now solve a large set of problems related to data management of containers across the entire DevOps cycle, from a single developer to a team of developers to QA, CI/CD, staging, and production all the way. So that's our vision. That's what we are working on. We have products that are in alpha versions right now, and we are doing beta testing and looking at KubeCon in November 1st week to do a major launch so that community can actually take that open source and start expanding on it.
Wow. Wow. So that sounds pretty good. I know I've got a lot of questions. I know Guillermo does too. So we want to get to that, but we're going to take a break. I apologize. We just have to take a quick break and talk about our sponsor real quick. But wow, we're going to come right back. I'm going to let Guillermo jump in and ask some questions because I'm sure he's chomping at the bit. But for right now, let's talk real briefly just about Casper. This episode of Floss Weekly, of course, is brought to you by Casper. Casper's great. They're the online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the cost. Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing the savings directly to the consumer. Casper's mattress is an obsessively engineered mattress at a fair price. They combine two technologies, actually, springy latex foam and supportive memory foam, to create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. The Casper mattress is a 2016 Business Intelligence Group Innovation Award winner, and their mattresses provide long-lasting comfort and support. You can try sleeping on a Casper mattress. Casper understands the importance of truly trying out a mattress that, in all reality, you spend a third of your life on. It's crazy. But what they offer is free delivery and painless returns with a 100-day period, so you don't have to lie down in a showroom. You can try it out. And did you know statistically lying on a bed in a showroom has no correlation to whether it's the right bed for you? It's actually very interesting. The Casper mattress is engineered to meet the Goldilocks standard of just right, so it's not too hard and not too soft. And they uphold the highest environmental production standards and are made in the USA. Free shipping and returns to the U.S. and Canada are available. You can get a Casper mattress today. It's about $500 for a twin or $950 for a king size. Compared to industry averages, that's an outstanding price. You can save an additional $50 towards your mattress purchase as one of our audience members just by going to casper.com/floss and entering the promo code FLOSS. That's casper.com/floss. And make sure you use the promo code as well, which is FLOSS. Terms and conditions apply, of course. And we thank Casper for their support of FLOSS Weekly. Okay, Guillermo, I know you've been waiting. I've been taking up too much of the question time here, so I'm going to turn it over to you. Go ahead, ask away.
No, it's fine. I've actually been learning a lot since this is not my area of expertise. It's I'm just watching you guys talk, and it makes me really happy that I just don't know what to say. So you did mention you had on this volume hub, right? Mentioned you had something like a Git for data.
Yes.
Would this work? And in my case, for example, I mentioned I'm a developer mostly, so I do use Git as my the way I organize a lot of my projects. And besides that, I also use it for my home directory. So I keep my email, backup of my email using Git and stuff like that. So I know it's kind of nerdy, but it does help a lot with dot files and stuff like that. So would this be something that I could actually use to make that whole transition better?
Guillermo, if you're saying you're going to use it for as a backup for your email, I'm not super excited about that. So I think it's kind of cool, nerdy, that you use something in such a different manner. Let me tell you what I think this will be used for. In order to, for a developer, you need three things. You need a code. You need your config files for the containers, assuming you're using containers. And you needed some kind of associated data. Now, I completely understand that in the early stages of code development, there may not be much testing against data going on, but sooner or later, the testing takes place. So this notion of code plus container config plus data, well, our vision is the code is managed through GitHub. The Docker containers configs are managed by DTRs, etc., and ClusterHQ provides the Git volume hub. Now, the beauty of this we need to do, and this is where ecosystem partners, Docker and GitHub and Jenkins and Kubernetes and Mesosphere need to really come together. We don't want developers to worry about it. We want to be able to do this integration. So as an example, if someone is doing a CI/CD system, then can we actually partner with Jenkins and CloudBees so that they are pulling their code from a Git repository? They're pulling their container configs from a DTR, Docker Trusted Registry, and they got a Jenkins master that is doing the configuration, and ClusterHQ's Volume Hub has done that integration. If you can do these things together, I think it can really make developers' life easy in terms of seamless testing, data management, et cetera, et cetera. What I would say in your case, it could be very powerful if you're a developer and you care about the data that you're using to do your testing against. It will be a repository for that. It is being done in a very smart manner. So as an example, if you have a data file and it is sitting on your laptop, you can publish it to the Volume Hub. And the next time when you publish it, instead of moving the full data set, it will only do differential snapshots. Oh, this is the other thing you'll love it. We are extensively using ZFS. So another open source component being not only used, but actually advanced. So what it means that you have data that is sitting on your laptop, you push it to Volume Hub. Aaron is your peer. He can pull that data down and use that for testing of his own code. If he wants to, he can create a branch of that data set and continue his testing. At some point, Aaron says, look, my branch of the data is actually relevant, and both you and Aaron can push it out, and the QA team can absorb that for their comprehensive QA testing. So this whole notion, as the code is evolving and associated with the code, there is a corresponding data that is used for testing is evolving. The code is maintained in GitHub. The data is maintained in Volume Hub. That's what we are thinking of.
Okay. So you mentioned differential changes. If I were to, right. Push up my data set, for example, for a test. A suite or something, how good is it at making that, I guess, looking at differences in binary files?
Yeah, so it's that's where it gets interesting. I think it is optimized for data sets. So if you have a Mongo or Redis or Postgres or Oracle data, then it is very, very good at it. It understands the data structure. It understands the data format. It takes the differential snapshots. Now, if you have a purely a binary file that you're doing it, then the ability to take differential snapshot is there, but it's not as going to be as efficient. So I think it's optimal for data structures. And the good news there is that it could be any data structure. It could be a traditional stacks coming from Oracle and SQL, or it could be NoSQL kind of workloads, Elasticsearch. It could be any of those things. So if you have a data structure and you're pushing it, and then you do a subsequent push, the differential snapshots are going to be highly efficient. snapshots. The other thing which is very interesting in this case is that we can create replicas of it. So as an example, when you think of a CI/CD environment, they do testing against a large number of agents testing. We can create data replicas. Those data replicas can be created and they could be destroyed after they have served the purpose. So even the data need not be, it's essentially the whole data copying problem can be managed now. So you only have, you have all the repository of data, and if you want, you can preserve it. If you don't want, you don't have to save all of that.
Okay. Let's say, for example, in I work on embedded systems a lot, and you don't really have the luxury of having, usually you don't have the luxury of having something like a Postgres direct, Postgres database on target.
Right.
Would I be able to maybe code something to make the differential changes better to,
get
that?
That's an interesting one. We'd love to actually sync with you. So embedded system, we have heard about it. That's something which we are looking at it. I think the way I look at it is that you won't have access to a Postgres, but you have some kind of data generation capability that is taking place, right? And you probably have some kind of data structure that is being manifested. It may not be to one of the known data structure, but it is computational science wise, it is a data structure, right? So in that case, I would say, yeah, the differential snapshotting will actually be quite efficient at it. The particular efficiency of it, I think it varies on how smartly your data structure is designed, but I think it's definitely doable. And I think offline, we can certainly talk about it. I'd love to take a look at your particular test case and see what we can do. See, guys, yeah. this whole notion of data management is actually a problem that is explosively getting more complex. When we were at NetApp, I'm sure you and I, we heard about it, is that for each bit of data that resides on production, there is 7x or 10x of data that resides in disaster recovery and backup and test data management, et cetera. So this whole notion of data management across the entire DevOps, I think is becoming a very complex problem. It's becoming particularly more complex that as we move from a traditional application development where there will be a monolithic application where someone was curating the data set, now it is going to be done using a microservice architecture with a bunch of developers using whatever the data structure of their choice. And that's exactly what we want them to do. But now imagine you have an application that consists of a large number of microservices. Each microservice is getting contribution from a bunch of these developers. These developers are doing their testing against writing their code and doing their testing against data sets. Well, what if these data sets are incompatible with each other? What if I'm making an assumption about use of a particular Chinese character in my data, but you are not aware of that as a requirement? Well, guess what? These things start manifesting at a later stage in the cycle, which is very detrimental to whole application development cycle time. So what we are saying is that just like Git came up with this concept of solving the problem of code branches, et cetera, and ensured that people could be on the same page, make sure you do the same for the data. And this gets particularly more powerful as you start thinking of containers. It's also very important to dispel this myth. This has nothing to do with, my container is stateful or stateless. Even a stateless container at some point consumes a data bit that could be coming from some other source. So this idea that you can actually have a data management associated with containers where developers can share the data, we can share it with a QA, CI/CD, and staging environment, and then Flocker is there in the production side to ensure persistency of data, you can now solve some very complex problems. You can ensure your stateful containers along with the stateless containers is the only environment you need for an enterprise's internal cloud. You can ensure that DR and backup problems associated with containers are solved. You can ensure that the data sharing is being solved. So the whole data management problem, our vision is a complex problem. It is exploding, and it requires some very deep thinking and good integration with other solution vendors such as Docker, Git, Kubernetes.
Okay. You know, all this talk about data migration and moving things around kind of gets me a little excited in the possibilities of how I can start applying this locally here, because I do have a lot of things. You know, I have like 6 laptops that I need to kind of have coordinated between. One is for one project. I'm mostly a contractor myself, so I have a lot of different projects that can't be close to each other sometimes, because the one company is rivals with the other type deal. So I started thinking, okay, maybe we can try and look at a practical use for this. In my case, there are a lot of times that I need to move not just data around, but, you know, like a tool chain, for example. I have a tool chain for a certain board that I'm working on, or maybe for a certain project, might even be a web project, for example, that I need to, one, get the tool chain ready, get the data set for testing, as you mentioned before, like, you know, actually something that might need a lot of constant updates. And I need to migrate that from my main PC, which is the one I'm talking to right now, over to my laptop over there. Right. Mm-hmm. And the way I do that right now is using rsync, which I know.
Yes.
You probably already know the problem with that.
And you know the problems with it. And this is just when you are doing it yourself. Right. Now, imagine you're a team of 6 or 7. And now what is interesting about this is we think that developers are going to continue using their laptops. But there is also going to be data generated and consumed in service machines sitting on AWS, right? So the idea that you now have a data hub, in fact, a bit hub, if you will, which can be used for pushing data, differential snapshots consumed by people. The other thing which is very interesting is that we are offering this volume hub both as a public SaaS offering as well as private SaaS. And let me expand a moment on it. We think it's very important to offer as public SaaS, so someone like you doesn't have to worry about maintaining your own AWS account and all that. It's a SaaS offering. You push the data, you pull the data, your peers pull the data. The monetization is going to be only for whatever you store, et cetera, right? Having said that, if I'm a large enterprise, I've got a whole bunch of data that is sitting either in my private cloud on-premise, or it is a VPC on AWS, right? In that case, I don't want that data to move outside the VPC or my on-prem environment, both for security reason as well as data gravity reasons, right? So in that sense, we are actually deploying after November, we are coming in Q1, a private SaaS edition of it, where the volume hub will actually get deployed inside your VPC or on-prem account. So the data movements are not going to be minimal. So both from a security point of view as well as data gravity point of view, it solves the problem. Nonetheless, what it is doing is it is making sure that the data, instead of sitting in somebody's individual AWS machine, is now actually available. If they choose to, it's available to their peers and to the broader team.
Okay, yeah. You know, that was the follow-up question I actually had, because there are a lot of things that I couldn't really legally, share with others. That might even include Amazon, even if they have their own terms of service that they would not, you know, look at whatever you store there. But, you know, legally, I couldn't really push anything up to the cloud. Not everything's like that, you know, especially open source software. That's a lot more easier to work with. Mm-hmm. Like if I had something local, right, something that I know might not be as secure, if my bunker here, my underground bunker were to explode, all my data would be gone, and that part is part of the risk, I guess, right?
Yes.
But this would actually solve most of that problem, and then maybe you can just have sections that do actually go into the cloud. I find that actually very interesting. I might have to spend quite a few hours learning more into this and actually making a workable system, because this is actually very exciting.
It is. It is. See, I think it's very important, Aaron and Guillermo, I'd love to hear your thoughts. Our viewpoint is, and my very strong viewpoint on this is, look, in open source world, several things needs to happen. One is that the core code associated with it should be open source. So the customers, our partners, our competitors for that matter, can actually take that and expand it rapidly. That's one thing. The second thing, it's very important that it should be infrastructure agnostic. One of the things at ClusterHQ we are passionate about is We don't want you to say, oh, using Flocker means I have to use AWS or GC or vendor XYZ. What we are saying is it should work across all infrastructures, right? Because as a customer, you should have a complete freedom to decide, am I using my laptop? I'm using my AWS. Do I want to use a public cloud? Do I want to use my legacy system, which could be from an IBM or EMC, because it has a value? So that's the second thing, is that an open source software should not impose an infrastructure requirement. The third piece, which is very equally important, is we think that while our solution should work out of the box, and that will require us to delivering solutions, which is tight integrations, we really don't want to take position on, oh, should it be Kubernetes or Docker Swarm or Mesosphere? We think our solution, our job, is to deliver our customers a solution which works across any of these orchestration frameworks, or for that matter, any of the container stack technology. And so this notion of open source truly is open, where our customers have and developers have a freedom to choose from. I think it's one of the core guiding principles that we have at ClusterHQ. And what this tells me is that we are working very actively. We are putting all our brains, all our passion in architecting a solution that solves a broad set of problems across in a orchestration framework agnostic, data service agnostic, storage infrastructure agnostic manner, so that it can be used broadly. And that actually makes the problem in some sense harder, because I could come up with a narrower solution. I could have said, oh, it works only on AWS, it uses only with Docker Swarm, and it works only with five data services, Mongo, Redis. And if you're doing something else, sorry about it. But we are really solving the problem in a broad manner, in a sense, embracing the open source community in its full dimension, and then saying, let's solve the problem for developers and the entire DevOps framework in a very holistic manner.
You know, this actually kind of reminds me of something. I now that I started thinking about this, if we start migrating data from one place to another, this might relate both to Flocker and Volume Hub in this case. If you do something like migrate data from one place to another, how do you handle licensing? For example, there are a few tool chains that require a license to be both on this machine and on the other if you use something on both. Is there a way for me to maybe code up something for me to, automatically, after deployment, ask for a new license, make everything on the back end pay and do whatever they need to, and then install the license file somewhere in the new migrated server? Is there something already like that in Flocker or in Volume Hub?
Yeah, Guillermo, I don't think we are doing anything directly on that. And let me tell you why. The way I look at it is that, let's take you have using a container, right? And it's on a node one. And you choose to spin up that container clone on node two. Well, really, the whole licensing availability of the services associated with that container on node two is, in a sense, part of your infrastructure responsibility, right? So the way I look at it is that if I have a data service that is on some, let's say, cloud one, and I port it to cloud two, some of the licensing management, et cetera, is something that will have to be addressed by your infrastructure team, which is I think is a norm. But I think what I understand you are saying is, well, what if I move from cloud one to cloud two? Can I actually port my license? Right?
That's right.
Is that right? Yeah, that's an interesting question. We don't do anything specifically for it. I'm sure that is a very interesting question, especially when you think about it, that almost everyone is looking at a multi-cloud or hybrid cloud environments where there is going to be flexibility to move things from location A to location B. Yeah, that's a very interesting question. We don't do anything directly on this one. We assume that if you're consuming a data service in a location, you have taken care of getting the appropriate licenses for that. that's a third party problem. So it's not even clear to me as on what we can do on this one. But it's something to think about. Yeah.
Well, again, this is just looking at things through a developer's glasses, if you will. Because in my case, I don't really have volume licenses unless I really need to, like if I'm managing some other team or something. But when it's just me, sometimes you just need to have, you know, in my case, I like to have things legally right and everything, just in case. You never know. So
And I think this is the other thing with open source. To me, open source does not necessarily mean free. Open source community, as you can see, is spending significant amount of resources, engineering talent in building these stacks. And there has to be a path for monetization of these things so that we can continue innovating in it. I recently published an article, I'll send it to you. It's called Long Live Open Source. I think we are very, very excited about making contributions to open source. And I'm glad that you take that legal responsibility seriously to make sure that the people who are making that contribution, whether it's a data service or Flocker or Docker or Kubernetes, that you take that licensing responsibility seriously.
No, it's always something important, especially when you work as a contractor. You know that somebody paying you or not paying you could be like a game changer, if you will.
Right.
It could be keeping the lights on for that month or not. So this is something at least very important to me. You know, that you have to keep in mind sometimes if it might not work for, in, you know, something for as big as an industry or something as big as even you guys, right? Because I'm sure you guys have volume licensing. I can just throw licenses all over the place. I don't really mind.
You're not that big yet. Okay?
Well, you will someday, I'm sure.
Yes, someday, very soon.
So in the developer section, if you want to look at this, and let me put my developer, my even bigger, thicker glasses on for a second, and maybe ask how accessible is this to developers? If I want to start working on Flocker or on Volume Hub, how accessible is it? Is there a community working behind this? Is there a wiki I could just go check?
Do
I need to sign something off? Maybe my rights, if you guys, for example, need to have all the licensing in the background, if you want to change something in the code, you won't have to contact me back or something. How would that work?
Right. So first of all, we should realize that the product Flocker is out there. It is being used in production. We have customers who have deployed. Swisscom is one of our customers. They have done a deployment of Mongo, Redis, Cassandra, name a data service for the entire Swisscom's PaaS. Is being done using a combination of Flocker technology along with a few other technologies like Docker and Kubernetes. So Flocker is production ready. We know customers who are using it. Very comprehensive set of resources available both by us as well as the open source community, IRC channels and things like that. So that is absolutely no problem. It is something you can download. You can just go to clusterhq.com and should be able to do it. The other two products which I talked about, Git for Data and Volume Hub, they are in alpha stages of it. The versions that you have today, they are very actively being worked on. We are right now doing private beta engagement. So if anyone is interested, ping me, mohit@clusterhq.com, and we can give you access to the code that is actually not published on our website right now. November 1st week at KubeCon, we are doing a massive launch where that code will become available to developer community, and anyone can go out, download it, play with it, change it, use it, branch it, whatever. So in that sense, it is going to be truly open source. I just want to make sure that these stages of development, it's very important for us to understand that data is very precious to people. We cannot just take an unproven solution and make it available in open source and just get a terms of service agreement and kind of wash our hands off it. And this is where people like Aaron and myself, those who come from NetApps and Symantec and VMware's and Oracle, etc., I think there's a tremendous respect that is given to enterprise data. So we are making sure that for Git for Data and the Volume Hub products are alpha. We are doing private beta testing right now. We have got some very exciting set of customers who are testing it for use cases as diverse from disaster recovery of a cloud that is built using containers to use cases of developers sharing data with each other. So this entire DevOps cycle, we are doing this testing. It is currently in private beta. Ping me and I'll make sure we'll work with you to make the code available to you, or starting in November, this code will be available for you to download, et cetera, with all the standard support that is there. It is something that is, I think we understand what the open source model is. Flocker was our first major contribution that we gave at DockerCon last year. Since then, I think we have made significant enhancements to Flocker. So I think we know what it takes to make a contribution to open source. We just want to make sure that it is done when the code has reached enough critical mass of goodness. So, and that is going to happen on November 1st week at Kubernetes conference.
Great, great. And I know you said both of those are going to be open source, completely open source as well?
Yeah. So Flocker is completely open source. Our current thinking on Git for Data and Volume Hub is also open source. What obviously is going to come with it is we are going to offer a public SaaS offering as, and eventually a, in Q1 of 2017, a private SaaS offering, which is how, which will be a ClusterHQ's commercial offering that can be used by you or any enterprise so as to actually get a solution that is supported by ClusterHQ using commercial terms similar to what Docker has done. But they are going to be open source. Yep.
Okay, good, good. Well, I've got a few more questions about your relationship with the open source community. And we've also got a question from the chat room. But first, we have to talk a little bit about Braintree. So Braintree is a new way to pay, let's say. You know, there's always something new coming along. Maybe maybe there'll be another Bitcoin or another Apple Pay, something else in between. Who knows? But fortunately, Braintree's full-stack payment platform is easily adaptable to whatever the future holds, so you can adapt easily too. You can accept everything from pounds to PayPal to that next big innovation from any device with just one integration. And when that new payment method comes along, all you have to do is update a few lines of code, which is great. Developers love that, right? No late nights, no complicated recoding, no stress about staying ahead of the curve. Braintree Payments is here to help. They offer simple, secure payments and code that you can integrate quickly. The Braintree code supports Android, iOS, JavaScript clients. They have SDKs in 7 languages, .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, my current favorite, and Ruby, and they offer elegant code with clear documentation. Braintree gives you an easy way to accept multiple payment types with one integration. Integrating it into your app is as easily as inserting a few lines of code. I know we're looking at it specifically at the makerspace because we have people that want to pay with Bitcoin and PayPal and all kinds of things. So I'm actually really excited to take a look at this and see what it can do for us at the makerspace. You can learn more, you can learn more at braintreepayments.com/floss. And we thank them for their support of Floss Weekly. That's Braintree.
Hey, Aaron, on that note, unsolicited comment. I think Braintree team is a fantastic example of how they've used container technology to evolve from a traditional way of doing application to microservices-based architectures and all that. So those of you who are developers, go check out Braintree. There are a couple of good case studies. These guys are fantastic in terms of adopting some of the cutting-edge thinking.
So they're using containers, as you may expect. I mean, what are they doing with them? Just real briefly, if you can share.
You know, I have to be careful. Some of the information we got, you know. So I think if you just type Braintree containers, Kubernetes, you'll get some good hits. But essentially what they're using containers is what the containers are fantastic at. Because the portability that comes with it, because you've got all your components associated with a particular virtualization is part of the containers. They are moved from a monolithic application model to microservices-based model. They're using AWS. I think there are some very interesting examples of how they have done the number of deployments, the number of deployments that are done weekly. There are some very impressive statistics there. So I think overall, it's a good example of how containers can help accelerate application lifecycle as well as developer productivity. Obviously, these are continuous processes. There are new technology that are coming from vendors like us and Kubernetes and Docker and Mesosphere and all of those guys, which will allow them to get even newer use cases. But as I look at it, I find some very interesting and creative usage of container technology to improve In the end, it comes down to, I think, two things. One is, are my developers productive? And second is that, is in the process, I'm able to application development in a faster and faster cycle time. And I think that's where containers are quite powerful.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I got a few last questions to ask you. We are running a little short on time, so I want to try to wrap this up quickly. The first one is, as a storage guy, you talked a lot about bringing a lot of the storage technology we've been using for years into a container environment, things like snapshots and deltas and things like that, so that you're not duplicating work. So I'm just kind of curious, are you using any of, let's say I'm a big company and I've got, you know, EMCs and NetApps and HP storage systems in my shop, are you using any of the native capabilities or the native features of those systems to do some of that work? Or is this all built into the software, your software?
We are actively, very aggressively using the underlying technology, driven by two reasons. I think one is philosophically, we believe that a single vendor should not go out and try to control everything. And this comes to what I said earlier, is our customers should have a choice of what they want to do. So ClusterHQ solution should leverage all of the underlying technology. But then there is a second very pragmatic reason. Aaron, you know it takes 20, 25 years to actually build robust storage technology. Building a file system is not a trivial task, right? So what ClusterHQ made a very smart decision, and I'm pushing that, and our entire team is pushing that, is leverage, collaborate with the infrastructure, whether it is AWS or NetApp or EMC or a next generation technology such as some kind of software defined storage. We are not aspiring to be a software defined storage layer. We are sitting above the software defined or a hardware storage components. And we are leveraging the underlying technology. So as an example, if I'm built on top of a NetApp or AWS or GCE system, then all the persistent, the HA, all of the capabilities that these systems provide, our customers should have access to it. What we are saying is that there is a class of capability which are needed to do integration. So as an example, ensuring that a persistent is consistent with what the orchestration frameworks are doing, what the container configs look like. So that's where we are doing. We are providing that significant IP layer, if you will, between the Docker containers, orchestration frameworks in the north, and the storage systems underneath. So we make use of it. The particular snapshot thing that I mentioned to you, we needed to come up with that solution because a lot of our developers were actually using their data service sitting on their laptop. So obviously, they are not going to use anything else. So we used ZFS. But as we develop our solution, we totally want to be able to use the underlying capabilities of storage systems. What, however, we also need to do is we need to be able to tell customers they can use a whole range of storage systems. So which means that if someone wants to put their data in AWS and move it to on-prem, we should be able to support both ends of it. So short answer, yes, we are using the underlying systems capability. We are looking at this holistically all the way from a laptop to private clouds to public clouds. And we are bringing a solution that we truly want it to be agnostic. So it can actually work across a very heterogeneous environment.
Right. And that's really important, especially for developers, because they don't want to have to worry about, hey, what system am I running on? Or like you say, maybe I'm just running on my laptop, or, you know, they don't want to have to worry about any of that. And they shouldn't have to worry about any of that. It should just
work
behind the scenes for them the same way every time. And so I'm really glad that you're doing this in a heterogeneous way. I think it's really important.
It does make the problem harder, though. I must say that it requires us to use our engineering muscle a lot more, because solving a narrow problem is much easier, right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. It's a big problem to tackle because there's tons of vendors out there. They all want their own thing. And then, you know, you're trying to write around this. So it absolutely is incredibly difficult. But I'm glad you're taking it on. I'm glad you're taking it on. Real quickly, let's take a question from the audience real quick. Virgil was asking, and I'm not sure I understand this entirely, but he said, how would this work in concert with IBM's Watson? Maybe you understand that question better than I do.
IBM's Watson. Watson is a big beast. Virgil, first of all, thanks for the question. Ping me if you find the answer to be not satisfying. We can take it on one of the offline channels. The way I look at it, that IBM Watson is an intelligent piece of software. As a developer, you probably will be using a whole bunch of queries potentially, which is running off Watson. If Watson exposes APIs that can be used by you in order to actually use the data queries, et cetera, you can actually capture the data from there and then use the ClusterHQ solution to move that data around. That's how we'll work it. If Watson get treated as a black box without any insight into the data which is there or any outputs from it, then I don't think you or I can do much about it. So I would say if the APIs are available and the data can be queried, then that data can be pushed, pulled into the system, and then it can be used to move around with your peers. So that's how I would look at it. But feel free to send me a quick link at mohit@clusterhq, and we can have a follow-on discussion.
Great. Thanks for that. Thanks for that answer. That's actually, that makes more sense now to me than it did before. What kind of license are you using for Flocker? And I guess that could change for the other products, but at least for Flocker, what kind of license are you using? And if you know, why did you choose that license?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And I actually I think this thinking is evolving. For Flocker, it's an open source license. It's a standard license, very much in line with a bunch of other open source community. What happens then is when somebody is using commercial services, then what do you do with it? And this is where it gets a balance between you want it to be open source enough that people are, it's not a proprietary system. You absolutely need to make sure that. But then you also need to be offered a appropriate level of terms of service because it's a commercial opportunity. So our thinking is evolving on this one. With Flocker, the licensing is fairly straightforward. With Git for data as well as Volume Hub, we want to maintain that general purpose open source licensing for it. The SaaS offering, I think, will have licensing that is going to be similar to the SaaS companies, which is going to be per use basis licensing, which is going to be per node, some combination of per node and per capacity kind of licensing. So as we in KubeCon in November, I think we'll announce the licensing, et cetera, a lot more details. So stay tuned for that.
Okay. All right. I think one thing to build on what you were saying, though, is that I think a lot of people, when we do these shows and there's a company around that's kind of like the parent company or supporting company that's riding on top of an open source piece of software, I think that there's some natural distrust that happens between the community and the company. People think, oh, well, they can't really be, you know, they're just building this for their own needs. And, it might be open source, but, you know, I don't know. There's some reason there's a mistrust. I'm not sure it's well-founded in companies that provide support or are shepherding open source projects in. So I guess my question is, and you've talked a lot about this already, but what's the relationship like with the community? Right. Do you have people working with developers actively? How many commits do you take from the community into Flocker, for example?
Right.
What's the governance like? I mean, just briefly, if you could touch on that, I think it would be helpful.
Yeah, that's a very good question. So first of all, I think our relationship with community is very high level of trust. I have not, to my knowledge, had anyone say, hey, I wanted to make a commit to Flocker and it wasn't accepted because of ClusterHQ. In fact, one of the interesting model of open source is the ecosystem may actually make a contribution, but it may not be directly into Flocker. So as an example, the 20 plus storage systems, the drivers for those are largely written by the underlying storage vendors themselves. So whether it is a NetApp or Pure Storage or EMC systems or Hedvig, they are the ones maintaining the drivers. So in a sense, they are making a contribution and with a full control over the drivers that they write. Well, that's a great example of it, right? Likewise, we are making contribution to Kubernetes and we are making a contribution towards writing PetSet controllers, et cetera, that we'll give it back. So I would say at this point, ClusterHQ, for better or worse, is small enough that we are very, very open to it. I don't think there is any one I can think of who wanted to make a commit that we didn't accept. The way I would look at it is, First of all, open source with a parent company is actually a good model. You want someone to be actually getting up in the morning and say, hey, what can I do to make this open source software more valuable? And that's what I do. That's what our team does. Where I think you're alluding to is when one company becomes so powerful that they want to control the entire stack. And there, I think, hopefully, my talk, as you will see more from ClusterHQ, the notion that we are heterogeneous system, the notion that we are not trying to be a software-defined storage or orchestration framework or a networking layer, tells us by our vision that we are going to play well with people in the north and south. I think to me, that is a great example of how a good open source citizen should behave. And that's what we are aspiring to be, is make sure the large amount of your code, whatever is available, is open source. Make sure you are addressing the problem of heterogeneity. Make sure that you don't have an opinionated stack which forces customers to get locked in into certain things. And these, to me, are the good behaviors of open source citizen. And once you do that, I think the community pays you. Community gives you reward for it by doing commits, by embracing solution, through evangelization, through monetary methods. And that's what we are aspiring to do. It's a journey that you're taking, just like each one of us are as an individual try to improve. As a company of an open source citizen, we will improve. If anyone has some brilliant ideas, share it with us. We'll listen it with an open mind.
That's great. That's great. I mean, I think it's hugely important, this relationship with the open source community and the business community, and trying to navigate. As you mentioned, you're trying to do this heterogeneously, and everybody out there is using, some are proprietary, some are open source, some are using their own stuff. I mean, it's like a minefield to navigate. Yeah. When you're doing a project like this. So, I mean, you have all my admiration for trying to keep open source at the forefront. And at the same time, try to integrate with all of these people.
Yes, that's important.
It's hugely important.
What you also can't do, and I think that is equally dangerous and useless, is to say, oh, we are heterogeneous Switzerland. Go and figure it out. Developers don't have time to do this stack. It is my job, along with my partners, fellow product managers and fellow CEOs and engineers, etc., to say, hey, here's a stack which is readily consumable by you. But that stack should not be an opinionated stack, right? So we are working aggressively in building a solution. For example, today you can have a Docker containers within the Docker orchestration framework and a Flocker technology with any of the storage platforms underneath. But instead of Docker, if you want to use Kubernetes, we have that stack as well. So I think you're absolutely right. Open source, we work with everyone else, should not be an excuse to say we are crappy with everyone. Our solutions need to be something which are consumable, digestible by developers, including things for third-party vendors such as GitHub and Docker and Jenkins and CloudBees and Kubernetes and Mesosphere. And I think that's the fun and tough part, actually.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Is there anything else that we didn't ask? Any questions that you feel like, I wish I could have talked about this? Or is there something that burning in your mind that you want to throw out to the audience before we wrap up?
I think you touched upon it, but it's worth highlighting two things. One is that the notion that the containers are for stateless service is actually a wrong notion. Don't limit yourself. Containers could be used for stateful services. What you need to do is smart about it and use the right set of solutions to it. And secondly, if there is absolutely anything as a company, as an individual, we can do to make your life better, you have some brilliant ideas, feel free to ping us on any of the numerous channels. We love to get contributions and ideas from our customers. So look forward to hearing from many of you.
Great. Great. So there's two questions we always ask, and we get in trouble if we don't ask these. So I'm going to ask them. And the first one is, what is your favorite scripting language?
Ah, oh, my goodness. Oh, this is, you should have asked it early on. Look, we are Flocker. A lot of that code was written in Python. So we definitely are some very savvy users of Python in our engineering team. The new code that we are writing, a lot of it is written in Go. So I would say Python and Go in ClusterHQ, Aaron, those of us who are old timers who came in 90s and, you know, early 2000s, how could anyone say that they could do anything without writing some variant of C? So I've seen some brilliant code written with that. But I would say the majority of code at Cluster HQ is Python and Go. But once again, we are not opinionated here, man. The job here is to get come up with a beautiful piece of code. And if that means we use something else other than that, you know what? We are open to it.
Great, great. And I don't know how much code you write yourself, but if you do, do you have a favorite editor?
Ah, gee. No, fortunately, my engineers, for my engineers and for my customers, I don't do much coding right now. But what I'm good at, I think, is, and I enjoy very much, is listening to lots of customer needs, coming up with what are the big trends that are taking place, and translating those into requirements that can be done by engineering and building really cool, neat, fun products. So, but it's funny that you talked about coding. Before we started the session, I talked about mathematics or juggling. My exposure to juggling was writing. Actually, my first program was through a programming interface as opposed to actually hands-on juggling. But those were a long time ago, man. So, and I think the world is a better place right now. But I think on a personal level, as a hobby, I definitely code.
Great, great. That's awesome.
Good.
Yeah, you can use that next time you're meeting with your engineers. You can throw out that question at the beginning of the meeting and let them. You know, what's your favorite editor you're using? Are you Emacs or Vi? And just you know, it'll take about 10 minutes to get the room back because they'll be arguing.
I know. I used to use Vi. If I were to answer, if you put a gun to my head, I'll say it's Vi.
Yeah, so, good man.
There we go. Yeah, if Randall was here, he would be upset. But I think Guillermo and I both like VI, so yeah, we're fine
cool.
with that.
VI is pretty decent editor. Yeah.
Good.
Cool.
Great. Well, Mohit, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to let us know what Cluster HQ is doing and give us an update on Flocker. So thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Aaron. Thanks, Guillermo. Look forward to hearing from you guys.
All right. Sounds
Cheers.
Good.
Take care.
Guillermo, what do you think about Cluster HQ and Flocker?
Well, what is there to think? I think I have a fairly good idea of what they do now, which I didn't know before. I had already, you know, I've already heard about Flocker and, you know, containers and stuff like that, even though I played like he didn't, you know. But now I actually have a clear idea how I can probably apply that locally here to help my way of working, which is something I didn't before. And maybe I can probably use this Git for data to replace my home directory stuff that I do with Git right now, which is perfect for emails and stuff like that since it's text, but binary, no go. So,
yeah. Well, it sounds like, I mean, the thing that I find interesting about that in particular is that it's expanding things beyond, it could expand things beyond just the developer world as well. Right. So, I mean, you know, we're talking about Docker and containers, and really this applies to agile development and things like that. But then once you take this, you could take this to another level, perhaps in the future, and use it more for production data and things like that. I think that would be an interesting application to see if you could do that. Certainly, this applies to a lot of where I work, you know, on a day-to-day basis. I work with developers mostly. And so this is really interesting to me. But it was interesting to hear your questions as well, which are, how can I apply this to my own personal development, you know, to my you're not an Oracle or a IBM or a big company, right? You're just an individual contractor who's doing development work, and how would you apply it to your own, you know, personal workflow? I think that's, you know, hugely interesting and not something that I was thinking about when we started the discussion.
Yeah, so, how is this going to apply to my cats? That's basically my question. How can I apply this to my cats?
Yes, how can the cats help me in my development work? I didn't see them behind there as we were talking. They were there earlier, but
yeah,
I must have frightened them off.
Nice.
Who's that guy? Awesome. Well, talk about, we don't want to frighten anybody off here on Floss Weekly. We actually want to encourage people to come and listen to our shows. So let's talk about what's coming up in the next couple of weeks here on Floss Weekly. So on August 16th, we'll be talking about Linux Presentation Day, and that's a non-commercial international event which offers the general public a look at Linux in everyday situations and the opportunity to test it out and ask questions free of charge. So it's kind of like a kind of like the opposite of a Linux user group, sort of. It's like a Linux user group for non-Linux users, basically. So we'll be talking about that next week. And then on August 30th, we'll be talking to LucidWorks. LucidWorks is an intelligent enterprise search engine based on Apache Solr and Apache Spark. So I'm kind of getting the idea here that it's kind of like running some sort of a Google search thing inside your organization, and maybe it mines metadata and things like that. I don't know. We'll talk to LucidWorks and find out. And then on September 6th, we're going to be talking to Midokura. Midokura? I guess I'm saying that right. It's basically enterprise virtual network management software built on an open source project called Midonet. So that'll be interesting to talk to them as well. Anything you want to plug, Guillermo, before we sign off?
Well, I guess if anybody here likes to watch my face saying things and, you know, making things, you can just Google my name, Guillermo Amaral, or just go into YouTube and search for Gamaral. I am not the DJ. I'll be like the third one down. That's pretty much it, I guess.
I saw you had a cool project. It was similar to one that I put out. It was a thing with a door entry system or something. I did this thing not too long ago. I talked about it on I think it was Twig a few episodes back, but it has this little keypad thing on it, and you could use it as a door entry. Although I just did a simple project for people that were learning Arduino so that they could touch in a combination and get it to play a sound file. But you did something similar, didn't you?
I've already kind of finished the project in this case, but what I'm trying to do is I'm making a segment on my channel there that we're going to study a product that already exists. In this case, I found one of these entry systems, right, that you can just purchase off of Amazon. We look for something that you might want to port that over into your own project. And then we design the system, build a board, and just make something, you know, customized. So that's basically it.
Yeah, cool. Well, people should definitely check out your channel. I know I see it pop up occasionally, and I always am interested in what you're doing because we do similar stuff. So that's great. As far as I'm concerned, you can follow me on Google Plus. I'm Aaron Newcomb on Google Plus. Also Aaron Newcomb on Twitter, and I'm also Aaron Newcomb on Facebook. So whatever kind of social media you want to use, you can follow me on any of those. And of course, I do the founder of Benicia Makerspace. If you're in Northern California and you're looking for a great makerspace, that's inexpensive and has all kinds of tools and cool stuff to use and training, definitely come check us out there. And you can also follow me on all the other shows on the Twit Network. So I was on the new Screensavers, for example, this past Saturday. Great show talking about all kinds of really cool technology, open hardware laptops, for example. And we talked about the smallest computer in the world. It's about the size of a grain of rice. If you missed that show, you really should go check it out. My mind was blown talking about that little computer. It was really amazing.
I saw that. It was great.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I was like, what? You're doing what? And it has a camera, and it's smaller than like the width of a coin. It's like, what? Yeah. It's mind-blowing what's going on out there. But yeah, just check that out. It's really cool. You can follow us in terms of Floss Weekly. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at Floss Weekly or plus Floss Weekly. You can join the chat room and ask us questions live. We always like to take questions from the chat room. That is irc.twit.tv, and you can watch the show live, of course, on live.twit.tv. So that'll do it. That wraps it up for here at Floss Weekly. Until next time, we'll see you later. Goodbye. It's Floss Weekly.